from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from the archives with Sue William Silverman, award-winning author of four memoirs, two poetry collections, and a craft book on writing. She teaches at the Vermont College of Fine Arts. She's also a professional speaker. In this conversation, we discussed her book, The Pat Boone Fan Club, My Life as a White Anglo-Saxon Jew. Last year, she published a new one, How to Survive Death and Other Inconveniences. Both books were published by University of Nebraska Press. The Pat Boone Fan Club is Sue's exploration of identity among the mishmash of American idols and ideals that confuse most of us, or should, with Pat Boone as the first stop. When I spoke to Sue, I began by asking her about the tone of the Pat Boone Fan Club, which is more ironic and humorous than her previous books had been, although it also tackles such serious subjects as searching for identity in a world in which she very much felt like an outsider. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Well, I think with the first two memoirs, it's true, they were dark. The first one was about, you know, growing up in an incestuous family. The second one was recovering from sex addiction. And to some extent, I think it's a matter of sort of pushing yourself as an artist, as a writer, that I do have other voices, different ways of expressing myself, and I sort of done the dark things. And to just sort of keep writing in that same voice almost would be, I hate to use the word boring, but kind of boring. And I think, you know, when we're told as writers to find your voice, that I think is very misleading. Because really what one wants to do is find the voice of the piece. And if you're writing about sort of growing up wanting Pat Boone to be your father, and Pat Boone is, you know, very religious, conservative, Republican, and I happen to be a Jewish atheist, liberal Democrat, obviously that has to be sort of ironic. I mean, there's no way you can sort of go just straight with that. At the same time, you know, I really did sincerely want him to be my father. So I think that there's that kind of conflict within the book is important to sort of note, but there, so that it can be both ironic and yet I write as a narrator who's sort of yearning for self-identity and you know, for a safe father.
Yeah. I think also the fact that he is who he is lends itself really well to that kind of conflict that you're talking about, because in a way he's almost like he's this untouchable star who isn't, he doesn't seem very real, right?
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't seem real. I mean, he's has this sort of this Pat Boone persona, and you know, back in the 50s and 60s, he was a famous pop singer, and now I can't really say that he seems sort of trapped in that time. Mm. And that, so when I did see him rather recently, he's still trying to be kind of the Pat Boone, and it's both sort of sad and touching.
Yeah.
But also just the fact that he could see me and hear me. I mean, he's read the book. He really likes it. And, you know, I was just out in L.A. I attended his 80th birthday celebrity roast birthday party. And he'd already read the book. And I saw him and, you know, he hugged me and gave me a kiss on the cheek. But then we were actually talking about the last line of the book is sort of metaphoric. And we were talking about metaphor, so here we are. I mean, he's also just really smart and intelligent. And he's just a contradiction in so many ways. But in a way, that makes it better to write about him. Because, yes, he does give off this sort of plastic persona. But when you stay with him, he is deeper than that.
Sure.
He'll maybe sort of let his guard down, sort of one-on-one.
Yeah. How many times have you met him?
So first time was just when I was a little teeny bopper living in New Jersey, and he had a live television show, and I got a ticket, and I went to see his show. So basically, that was just, I gave him this book to be autographed, and he had written this book to 12 and 20. So you can count that, because that is when it started, but I didn't even speak to him. I was, like, so freaked out. But then as an adult, I've now seen him three times. You know, the first time after this concert that was, like, in 2005, and that's what's made this whole book sort of kick-started the whole book into being, was that I did go to this concert a few years ago, and just because I'd had a crush on him all these years, I realized he was going to be 20 minutes from my house. I got a ticket. I went. And afterwards, I just barged backstage and sort of threw myself at him and told him, you know, how he'd been this father figure to me growing up and everything. And he was sort of looked a little scared, like, who is this woman? But he was also very gracious. And then I'd given him a letter to read that explained in more detail. And then I did write this, what became the first essay in the book called The Papoon Fan Club, that somehow he managed to find in this literary journal. His best friend saw it and sent it to him, and I got an email from Pat Boone, and he thanked me for writing it. And then he said he was going to be back in Michigan, which is where I live, and he invited me to his Christmas concert, and he sort of officially invited me backstage to have like a real conversation with him, as opposed to the first time when I just barged in. So I did, so I went backstage afterwards, and he sat down with me, and I mean, he was so sweet. I was wearing this jacket that had this like embroidered flower on it, and he had read my first two memoirs, and so he sort of pointed to the flower, and he said, "You remind me of a flower growing up through concrete." And like, he really saw me like as a father should, but as my own real father never did see me.
Yeah.
So I mean, it really, you know, he can see me.
Yeah.
And that's just so amazing to me, you know, to go from this little teeny bopper high school crush or junior high school crush to like now he knows who I am and he's reading my books. It's just, it's amazing.
It's very cool.
It's very cool. I know.
I found it interesting that despite eventually having something of a friendship with him or a correspondence and seeing him these times and in writing these essays, you always refer to him by his full name, Pat Boone, every single time. You never just call him Pat or Mr. Boone. So this was a choice that you made. Can you talk about that choice?
Yeah. To me, he really is that, still that Pat Boone star.
Right.
I mean, to just call him Pat suggests that we have a very close friendship, which we do not, really. And Mr. Boone sounds formal, and that's not who he is. He is Pat Boone.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that celebrity persona is Pat Boone.
Right.
And I just can't think of him in any other way. I mean, actually, when I saw him in person just recently at this birthday party, I did call him Pat because it just seemed too weird to call him, "Hey, Pat Boone." But in writing the book, definitely it was Pat Boone.
Right, right. Okay, I enjoyed that. And, you know, actually, now that you're saying that, it makes sense in another way, too, because neither Pat nor Mr. Boone fits being a father figure.
Right.
Whereas Pat Boone, the icon who was just a father figure by virtue of being a star... That works.
Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the structure of the book, which is something else that was a little bit different. Each chapter feels like a unique, separate entity. And you just mentioned that they were essays, which I suspect is the answer to this question. Some of them read kind of like straight narratives that readers might sort of feel more used to. And then some are very different. Like in several places through the book, you present chapters that offer guidance to your gentle or Gentile sometimes reader in the form of a letter from a narrator who seems to be gefilte fish.
Right. Strange as that may sound.
So, right. So this is unusual structurally. I mean, there are other things that I'm going to ask you about later structurally, but let's talk about those letters. How did you come to that?
Ironically, the letters were the very last thing that I wrote for the book. So I had these. At first, I mean, I didn't even know I was writing a book. I was just sort of writing kind of what I thought were standalone essays. And I'd been working on the project for about a year when I realized, oh, I seem to be exploring my relationship to Judaism. How interesting. And I did not know that I was doing that. And so what I did then is I basically revised most of the essays. Some I didn't have to, but I revised a lot of the essays to more clearly fit that theme so that they had been standalone, they had been published, but I made them, rewrote them to more clearly fit the theme of the book. But then after all of those essays were collected into this one book, I still felt that I needed a kind of through thread that would hold all of these essays together. And those came out in the sort of that epistolary, you know, sort of 18th century or whatever form of Dear Reader. So I could really kind of present to the reader, well, this is really what I'm struggling with, you know, that I am struggling with my identity and I don't know who I am and I'm trying to find out who I am. And the gefilte fish metaphor came to me because a gefilte fish, for those of you who do not know, isn't really a fish. It's just this sort of conglomerate of fish parts from all sorts of fish just kind of put together into this thing. So a gefilte fish doesn't have an identity either. So I started totally identifying with this gefilte fish. Listen, I know how surreal it sounds.
I love that, though.
I mean, it just sounds so weird. But it seemed to work. So I guess there are about four or five of those dear reader sections sprinkled throughout the whole book to kind of give it that idea of being a real thematically cohesive collection of essays.
Okay. Now, to what extent when you were growing up were you an affiliated Jew, a practicing Jew?
Hardly at all. Hardly. I mean, when I lived in the West Indies, we did go to synagogue some Saturdays, not real often, but some Saturdays. But I knew nothing about the religion. When I did go to the temple, I didn't feel anything. It was just, you know, there I am. And as I write in one of the essays, the temple in the West Indies in St. Thomas had sand on the floor. And I used to just basically sit on the floor and play with the sand. So that's how religious I am. And I mean, I really always did kind of want to be Christian.
Yeah.
And I, various times, I had a rosary. Most of my friends, were Christian. My two ex-husbands are both Christians. Not that they're practicing either, but they were born Christian. And I have never joined a temple or synagogue. And it just, now where I'm at, I do feel more Jewish, but not in a religious way. It's more in a way of identifying with a kind of culture.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, I believe in the state of Israel, so I'm a Zionist, in that sense.
Yeah.
But the religious aspects, they just don't really speak to me. I mean, I just don't know how to feel that.
And it's interesting because being raised without the religious aspects, of course, that wouldn't be something that you identify with. And yet, every Jew who is known to be Jewish will be identified by other people as Jewish.
Absolutely.
And probably still, but certainly then.
Absolutely. I mean, everybody who knows me would say, what religion is Sue? They would say, oh, she's Jewish.
Right.
Absolutely. I mean, when you're sort of other and you're not part of the dominant culture or religion, that's how people see me.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
Or all of any, yeah.
Now, you did live in Israel for a while.
Yes, I worked on the kibbutz.
Mm-hmm. And I remember that was a great essay because it was sort of like the first time that you felt like you fit in, and that was such a lovely piece. Actually, there were a few pieces, but the one piece that was very short, I'm wondering, actually, you want to read that one real quick?
So this is really the shortest essay in the piece, and the title is For Jews Only. Teenage boys dive bomb into the pool, spraying water, or they sneak behind girls, grab them, and toss them in. Girls' voices shriek in mock anger, but I can tell they like being singled out, noticed. I dab copper tone on my nose and shoulders. Humidity frizzes my dark auburn hair. Here, I look like the other girls. They look like me. Is this why no one talks to me, notices me? I don't stand out. In the distance, men in caps stroll the golf course. Women play mahjong, a Chinese game. Men play a Scottish game. I slide into the water and lie on my back, barely bobbing on the surface. The mahjong words sound like a meditation, a poem, a chant. Women wearing straw hats and sunglasses sit beside the swimming pool on patio furniture, speaking exotic words as they play. Tiles click. Plum, orchard, chrysanthemum, bamboo, dragon tiles, season tiles, honor tiles, prevailing winds, east winds, west winds. Sun warms my face. Water cools my back. I am at the Westwood Country Club in Bergen County, New Jersey. But I could be in Shanghai. I could be Chinese. So there, basically, it's that setting, of course, is a Jewish country club for Jews only. And in a way, I both fit in there, but realize still I could be anywhere. I mean, I could be in China, because just growing up, I really could kind of glom on to any identity or any religion or any country, just searching for this, who am I?
Right, right.
Because I didn't feel Jewish, and because my father sexually molested me, I didn't feel part of that family. So I always felt like, well, I'm up for adoption, you know.
Yeah.
And I use the word adoption very loosely in that it could be by a family, a country, a religion, anything.
Pat Boone.
Pat Boone, absolutely. Oh, yes. I mean, that's the whole point, was I wanted Pat Boone to adopt me. And alas, he never did. But at the same time, as I said earlier, I think ultimately he did kind of see me as a daughter. And he, by him seeing me as a daughter, I could see him as kind of the good, safe father that I always thought that he was.
Yeah. And what a wonderful thing that he, upon your initially kind of blundering backstage and trying in a bit of a nervous rush to explain yourself, that he didn't just turn his back and walk away and say, this lady...
Yeah, it's nuts.
Yeah.
No, he never turned away. That's the thing. I barged backstage. He listened to me. He accepted my letter. He wrote to me after I'd published the first essay. He invited me backstage. I mean, he just is a lovely, lovely man.
Yeah.
And that's what makes him interesting because, yes, he does have this very strident sort of right-wing conservative leaning where he can be really outspoken in ways that I would just... don't believe or agree with him on any level, but as a person, he really is very sweet.
Yeah. Some of the book deals with your reaction to having been the only Jewish student in your circle in high school, and basically in that entire community. I mean, I don't think you had more than a couple other people in your school who were Jewish, and having to experience sort of in this sort of solitary state all the mentions of Jews in literature, many of which seemed unattractive or unkind. You mentioned that in The Sun Also Rises, Jake says of Cohn, he had a hard Jewish stubborn streak.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think other people looked at you in these moments as the representative Jew, or do you think that that was mostly something you were putting on yourself?
Well, the interesting thing is that at the time, I thought that, everybody saw me as just, you know, this other Jewish and, you know, but I made friends and I, you know, sort of tried to overcome all of that, but I think ultimately I was seen sort of as other. What's ironic is that thanks to Facebook, I'm now in touch with quite a few people from my high school, and they didn't see me that way at all.
Isn't that funny?
They really, like, one woman in particular, who I didn't even know her that well in high school, she said, I always looked up to you, and I always thought you were so beautiful and just different looking. And of course, I felt like, yes, I was different looking, but I didn't want to look Jewish, I wanted to look Christian. I mean, it's just bizarre how we see ourselves. I mean, which, and a lot of that is just typical high school stuff.
Absolutely.
Because I think everybody struggles in junior high and high school and wants to be perfect and look like everybody else and not be different, and everybody's having the same struggle.
Right.
But nobody can really talk about it because we're too young to sort of know how to approach that. So it's really has been eye-opening to meet these people now on Facebook to think that they liked me. Like,
Sally Fields.
I know, they liked me. I want to go back now and do it all over again.
Like Robin Hemley did.
I know, exactly.
Do over.
Yeah.
Speaking of feeling like an outsider or you didn't fit, I loved the information that you've shared about Natalie Wood. And I'm not going to read it because I don't know how to pronounce her birth name. But this was so interesting. She was born Russian.
Yeah, she's
in San Francisco.
Exactly.
And then she's playing a Puerto Rican woman
in West Side Story
who wants to be white, basically.
Yeah.
Or who wants to fall in love with the white boy.
Right.
I loved that. And then you said that at her funeral they played Russian string music.
Right.
Which was never anything it sounded like she ever really identified with either.
No, I know.
It's so interesting.
I know. I just started doing some research on her, and I just found this wealth of information, which totally fit in. I mean, these are like gifts when you're writing a book.
Absolutely.
And then you find these details that totally sort of fit your message.
Yeah.
And you can use, because, you know, Natalie Wood, you know, as a movie star back then, you know, of course I wanted to be her too. I mean, and to find out that we weren't so dissimilar.
Yeah.
So except she, of course, was famous. And
except she was Natalie Wood.
Yeah, right. I was not, other than that.
So I once attended a lecture that you gave about windows in literature and noticing the way we use windows in our work. And in this book, you have a great window moment, probably more than one, but I remember this one, and I wonder if you mind if I read it.
Sure.
Is that okay?
Yes.
So you're in English class. I watch the backs of Christopher's wrists through lowered lashes. The winter sun slanting through the row of rectangular windows casts the wispy hairs in platinum light. Last autumn, the sun tinged them a reddish yellow. By June, I know I'll still be spying on him. After weeks of baseball, they'll deepen to gold. I rest my chin in my palm, canting toward him, inhaling his scent of ivory soap and juicy fruit, gum. The overlap of his front teeth, this one small flaw, makes me want to kiss him, though he's never even held my hand. I, with my darkness, feel almost inchoate at the presence of such incandescence. So I loved that paragraph, and it reminded me of your talk about windows, and I wondered if you could talk about your use of windows or your thoughts about using windows in literature.
Sure. I think that, particularly in creative nonfiction, the idea of whether you have a physical window or just write sort of with the idea of it, but that a lot of memoirs are labeled narcissistic and navel gazers and everything, and I take deep exception to that because we're not. And the reason why I take exception to that, because if you're writing, you know, literary memoir, literary creative nonfiction, you are writing as if the self is superimposed on a window, that there's a whole world out there, and that your message is much more universal. So it's looking out of a window as opposed to staring into a mirror.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, say the memoirs that fail, or the ones that just critics want to attack for the sake of attacking, they, you know, label them narcissistic. And it's true that if the author is just sort of writing about the self as if looking into a mirror so that all you really can see is yourself, then there is a kind of narcissistic bent to it. But if you introduce the idea of a window and this whole outer world and sort of the interplay between the self and the world that's seen through the window, then there is a kind of energy between self and world. And then the metaphors that one discovers by looking out of the window do make the work, you know, rather universal.
Right.
So it wasn't anything that I do consciously.
Right.
It's
right.
Just that unconsciously, I think that I do write with a sense of a kind of universe out there, and that I'm trying to find my self-exploration, my search for identity, is layered over, you know, these sort of larger issues, say like religion and identity with this world out there that can sometimes offer you pieces of your identity, but it's a way to kind of search for your identity by sort of looking out the window. There's a place to go to kind of see the self.
Right. And you said something earlier about how you hadn't really thought about how Pat Boone, you know, was this ultimate father figure to you until you started writing about it and looking at it maybe through this different perspective, and looking out these windows maybe helps us see our story in a different way.
Exactly. I mean, if I had just written about Pat Boone, say, looking into a mirror, then he would just always only be Pat Boone, the movie star, pop singer.
Yeah.
But by being able to kind of see him within this more world view, which would be one of looking out of a window, then I'm able to discover these other aspects of him, that he is this really kind, gentle, sort of caring man.
Mm.
And if so, that's sort of the portal into which I can sort of enter that material.
Right.
As if I am writing about him, looking at him, religion, and all that represents, as if looking out of a window.
Right. And in fact, I think that the excerpt that I chose to read is beautiful, but it doesn't, in fact, talk directly about what you're talking about, because you're not looking out the window. You're using the light coming through the window to light something that you're looking at, but
right.
Still.
It's sort of, no, it is the same idea, because yeah. It's just that what the window can introduce into a scene is really sort of what I'm getting at. In the part that you read, the light is coming through the window. So that does introduce this idea of this whole world out there that can enter me and enter the scene,
So
that I'm not just trapped in this kind of very sort of narcissistic place in terms of being trapped in the self, but that the world is introduced. So the window is a two-way street in that sense.
It's about movement, too, in a way. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, great. Thanks. I love the chapter that you titled The Wandering Jew, which has to do with a homeless man, a tramp, who you noticed and became very focused on as a child living in St. Thomas. And he would walk the streets striking a musical triangle, and he didn't really speak or stop or interact with people. And you were fascinated by him, and I thought that was really interesting for a few reasons. I think I've heard from other people their stories of having noticed adults who were perhaps mentally ill or childlike or vulnerable in some way when they were children. And this, to me, really spoke, because I felt like, yeah, you know, when we're children, we see these people and we're very curious about them. So I loved this chapter. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that and about including the essay in the book.
Sure. And that is one essay that had been a standalone, and it was more sort of focused on the tramp and just the hypocrisy. This took place in the West Indies, and the hypocrisy between sort of the white people who lived there, who, you know, like with me, my father's molesting me, a lot of my friends, their parents were alcoholics. I mean, they presented this perfect picture, mm-hmm. but it was so hypocritical because behind closed doors they were abusing their children, hurting them, and then this
your friend Vicky, right?
Exactly, yeah, right. Her father beat her, and then this tramp represented a kind of who was of the islands, who was a West Indian, and he represented a kind of purity. He sort of lived in nature, so he represented a very pure image to me, a kind of a metaphor for purity, and by focusing on that, he became a kind of savior persona. So in that sense, he's a metaphor in the same way that Pat Boone is a metaphor. Even though he's a homeless tramp and Pat Boone is this movie star, in a way they serve the same purpose in terms of the book, in that this homeless tramp, given this sort of, he's untouched by sort of hypocritical white people. He's untouched by things or money or ownership. I mean, he's just this person who he can just live in nature, mm-hmm. and he doesn't need all of the trappings. And so, to me, that's almost like a Christ-like persona, and a kind of I never met him. I never did speak to him, nor did I need to. I just needed to know he existed, mm-hmm. and that I could follow him, and sort of felt safe just following him at a distance, that knowing that he wasn't going to hurt me, mm-hmm. and that, so he becomes a sort of savior persona in the book.
It's interesting because it's clear that when you were a kid, you were very curious, and that curiosity sort of saved you in a lot of different ways and times.
Oh, it did. I mean, because, you know, when you're living in an incestuous family and you don't think that there's a way out, it is a matter of sort of finding these windows and what's outside those windows as ways to hold on to a sense of reality and a sense of self, and to know that there are there's a larger meaning out there, so that even though the tramp and Pat Boone are very different, they serve the same purposes, in that I could sort of fixate on them and know that there was something else out there. And as a kid, I didn't know, of course, I didn't have the language to understand any of that. And in fact, I did not have the language to understand until really I started writing about it. And that's when I came to understand that, oh, Pat Boone was this father figure, this tramp was this a savior, which we also can sort of think of as a father figure. Mm-hmm. And so by writing about them, I was able to understand the significant role that they played in my life, and that, and I did, I also latched onto the other tramp, Charlie Chaplin, mm-hmm. in that chapter as well.
Right.
And I was fixated on Charlie Chaplin for years. In fact, I'm still sort of fixated on him. But because the tramp also, in terms of the book, sort of saved young girls. And so I just would fixate on these people and or events that seemed safe and that could sort of keep me alive until I sort of found out how to sort of save myself.
Yeah. They sort of promised hope or escape, yeah, or
absolutely.
Other.
Exactly.
Another
all
life.
Of that.
Yeah.
All of that, faith, hope, meaning, mm-hmm. metaphor. And again, I couldn't have put any of that into words at the time. I didn't need to. Just knowing that they existed, mm-hmm. was what kept me alive in many ways.
Speaking of being alive and almost not, you write about your experience with an illness that you had, C. diff.
C. difficile.
C. difficile. From which you became very, very ill, and people have died from this. It took a long time for them to diagnose the illness and help you treat it. And you suffered long-term consequences, including losing a great deal of weight, some of which you never were able to put back on. So I have two questions about this. First of all, how soon after you were better did you write this, or were you able to write about it while you were experiencing?
No, I did not write about it while I was experiencing it, I wrote about it probably about 2 years afterwards.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this, to me, is an example of writing about a personal experience where you, as the author, felt wronged because the medical system really failed you.
Yes.
You've written about other experiences of having been wronged, such as you mentioned, your father's sexual abuse when you were a child. And I'm wondering what advice you have for writers of memoir, I think probably more specifically, or poetry, or people who are writing about their own experiences, about writing from a place of abuse or victimization or mistreatment. How would you suggest that writers approach these subjects? I guess I'll just leave it at that. How?
Well, I think that it's important to tell our truths. And even if we're going to upset other people, that's not my job to even worry about that. Mm-hmm. I see my job as a writer is not to make people feel comfortable. It really is to tell, look, this is my truth, and I own my stories, and I can write about them. And I can't say I don't care if I upset people, because I do. I mean, I feel badly, I guess, if I upset people, but not enough to stop me from writing about it. I mean, I just have to, if there's an event or anything that happens to me that I have to figure out and make sense of, I'm going to write about it. And I just feel that's really crucial, because if we don't tell our stories, nobody's going to tell our stories. And as writers, that's all we have. Really, regardless of whether you tell it as fiction or poetry or creative nonfiction, they're still our stories. Mm. And the goal of an artist is to be heard, is for our voices to go, to be out there.
Right.
And so I just think it's imperative for us to tell our stories.
One addendum to my question is, or a comment, is I never get a sense of your writing out of a motivation of revenge in any way. So I wonder if you can just address that.
That's absolutely true. I absolutely, in fact, I'm usually harder on myself than anybody else, because I don't think writing out of a place of revenge will help us understand what that episode meant or what our journey means.
Yeah.
It's really just like kind of payback. I write from a point of wanting to understand what something meant to me, and how does that fit into my whole life, and what are the metaphors of the experience. That's why I write anything. And so it's not to get back at anybody or to overtly try to make somebody feel bad or anything. I don't. I mean, I really write to understand my own experience, and I strongly encourage other writers of memoir to not think about it in terms of revenge either, because I don't think that that is what memoir is about at all.
Mm.
It really is about telling our truths and understanding them and kind of giving an organization and structure to our lives that we wouldn't just see in the living of life. You know, I mean, writing a memoir is taking a life and turning it into art.
Mm-hmm.
It's not Xeroxing a life. In real life, do I feel I hate that doctor who gave me those antibiotics that made me sick? I mean, just seriously ill. I mean, I really despise her. But I don't have to write about that, because I know that to be true. And so what was more important to me is to understand what that disease meant, and how life is so fragile, and how just through no fault of my own, all of a sudden I was given antibiotics for an illness I didn't even have.
Right.
But at the same time, oh gosh, this is so weird, but yes, I regret ever having that C. difficile infection, because it was so awful. But it really fits the book so well, because when I went to see Pat Boone, I was still just recovering. And it was a kind of like when he hugged me, it was a laying on of hands to cure me. I mean, it so fit with the theme of the book that I was happy to have that. But at the same
time, write about.
I was not, in real life, I was not happy to have the C. difficile infection. But in terms of writing the book, I can't. It helped the book.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's a very odd place to be.
Well, it is funny, though, isn't it?
It is.
Because writing becomes more than just a way of working through your truth, although you hope that's what it does.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's fun. Well, Sue, those are all my questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your interest in my book. Thank you.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Sue Williams Silverman. You can learn more about her work at suewilliamsilverman.com. This week's Write the Book prompt is to write about a fantasized, imagined, or real relationship with a star. From Pat Boone to David Cassidy, Britney Spears to Timothy Chalamet, heartthrobs have always energized teens. You could write from a fan's perspective, a star's, that of an agent, a producer, a chauffeur. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Poem City is now accepting submissions for their National Poetry Month poems that will be displayed in storefront windows in downtown Montpelier businesses for the month of April. So those submissions are being accepted through February 7th. More information at Colored through the Kellogg Hubbard Library. And you can, I think, actually go to kellogghubbardlibrary.submittable.com/submit if you have poems that you'd like to send. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We are also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and lots of other sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Facebook, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it on iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. Up next at 5, stay tuned for Feminist Frenzy, the radio show with a feminist agenda. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3, WBTV.org. Stay well and have a great week.